Yeah, so I was in, I must have been in second grade. My family moved homes. Mm-hmm. So we're at a new school. No kids with turbans had ever gone to this school before. Nobody had ever seen anyone who looked like me.
Wow.
And so ask my teacher to use the bathroom. So I remember walking to the bathroom, getting to the boys' bathroom door, and there were a couple of fifth grade kids standing outside who I didn't know. But they kind of laughed and pushed me and said, "You have long hair under that thing," talking about my turban. Mm-hmm. "You have long hair under that thing, so why don't you use the girls' bathroom?" And they pushed me towards the girls' bathroom, like a couple of them. And then they said, "You know, you can come use the boys' bathroom when your hair is short and you look like one of us." Mm-hmm. And I remember actually that night, I don't remember feeling this way before. But that night, I actually snuck a pair of scissors under my pillow, planning to cut my hair, which, you know, in our religious tradition, it's like, it's not acceptable. And so that super traumatic for me as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
One of my very first memories as a kid.
Simranjeet Singh was maybe 7 or 8 when this happened and hasn't really thought about it since. He didn't actually get around to cutting his hair because he was waiting for his parents to fall asleep, and he accidentally passed out first. That's how young he was. But that memory still shaped the kind of man that he would become. Simran is a scholar of religion and has become a kind of cool-headed, self-made ambassador for the Sikh community. But he didn't start there. I'm Ayman Ismail, and you're listening to Man Up. On this show every week, we tell honest stories about our lives and investigate where we get our ideas about what it means to be a man. So, I don't usually wear traditional garb, but a few weeks ago was Eid, the Muslim holiday, and this year I was trying to get back to my roots. So I wore a gelabeya, as we call it in Egypt. It's this big, white, ankle-length garment with long sleeves that looks Middle Eastern and very baller. My family and I went to the zoo that day, and the funny looks began almost right away. I noticed the difference in how people saw me. At first, surprise, then suspicion, then caution after they noticed me doing something disarming, like laughing or smiling. When I was a kid, I would never have done that. I didn't want people to see me any different than they already did, so I tried to blend in. Simran didn't really have that choice, though. He's sick, and that means he couldn't really hide.
It was one of my pet peeves as a kid, you know, because I had long hair. I have 3 brothers. All 4 of us have relatively feminine features. So before the beard and mustache came in, like, everyone always confused us for girls. So it was a pet peeve for sure, but only because I thought people weren't really understanding or weren't really seeing me in that way.
They were instructing you on, like, what a man was supposed to look like and how a man was supposed to behave?
I don't know if it necessarily enforced an idea of what it meant to look like as a man, but it definitely gave me this feeling that what I was doing, the way that I looked, the way that I lived, didn't fit into what people expected of me, and that either I could continue my way or I could move into somebody else's, but I couldn't do both.
In San Antonio, Texas, Simran and his 3 brothers stood out. They all wore turbans. A lot of his neighborhood had never seen one before, except on the news. Never mind that he was sick, not Muslim. He was a brown kid with an unfamiliar religion, and they expected him to prove their ideas wrong. That can be a lot of responsibility, especially on kids still insecure about the way that they look.
So I always had this urge to compensate for the way that I looked. I would smile more and smile at people at a distance who I thought were visibly uncomfortable by who I was and the way that I presented myself. So I always tried to put on this like happy face and try to be like the friendly neighborhood Muslim guy. Did you do anything like that when you were growing up?
I definitely. So culturally in Texas, like in San Antonio at least, if you don't say hi to everyone you pass by on the street, you're being rude. And so like I always said hi to everyone, always smiled, but everyone did. So it wasn't like particular to me. I didn't think of it as like a I need to present myself as a model minority or something like that.
Southern hospitality.
Yeah, exactly. But there are things that I am thoughtful about, right? Mm-hmm. So think about this coming from the perspective of someone like myself. You walk through airport security. Everyone's already like skeptical of you.
Yeah.
Then you go through airport security and you get pulled aside.
Oh, man.
And for a secondary screening, right? Like a standard racial profiling practice. Mm-hmm. And this is like part of the policy, right? So it's every single time.
Yeah, sometimes you get brought to the Muhammad room. I call it that because you're sitting there waiting for your name to be called and it's just Muhammad, Muhammad.
That's hilarious.
Muhammad. It's just over and over.
Yeah. Then everyone's looking at you, right? And they're like, mm-hmm. Oh, if those guys are scared of, if the government's just scared of these guys, then I should probably be worried about them too.
Yeah.
Then you get to the gate and everyone's like, oh damn, that guy's on my flight, I don't want to sit next to him. Then you get on the airplane and everyone's like, oh shit, like this is real. And so I'm thoughtful about that, and like when I'm with my girls now, I find it's totally different, right? Like they're two little babies and people are like, oh, that guy might be a real human, right? But if I'm not but when I'm not with my girls, like sometimes I'm thoughtful now about like, should I speak in Punjabi or English if I'm on the phone?
Yeah.
Or should I like hear something? Like if I have my headphones in, people like treat me very differently than if I don't. Because if I have my headphones in, they're like, oh, that guy's probably a modern, normal person. Like they hear that I don't have an accent, they're less worried. But then again, I find that all those things to be a compromise for myself, because I'm like, why am I changing who I am to make these people feel comfortable? Like they should be accepting me for who I am. So it's one of those things where no matter what I do, I'm like, man, I wish I didn't have to do this. I think that's the end result.
Yeah, it's taxing. And it's one of those things that you have to consider everywhere you go. It's kind of interesting. I always tell people when they ask me, when did you become so religious? People who knew me when I was younger, it's when I started becoming so exposed to Islamophobes and where I felt like I needed to be confident in what I was saying in order to compensate for my just being different. I needed to stand strong and resolute like you were describing. I think back to those moments, those like sparse moments of being reminded that you were different just by the way that people treat you is unexpected. And it takes me some time to remember them, especially as they happen. I don't necessarily think, this is an Islamophobic thing, or oh, this is kind of racist, or oh, it just kind of happens, and then afterwards, like, wait, was that racist?
Yeah, my brothers and I had this really funny conversation recently. I mean, funny but sad too. We went to a public high school just outside of San Antonio, and one of my brothers said, "Hey, am I remembering this wrong? Do you remember Confederate flags on the backs of the pickup trucks at our school?" And all of us sort of like paused for a second. We're like, "Yeah, like there were a lot of those, and like it didn't strike us as weird when we were kids, but like it's totally weird. I mean, like." A lot of my childhood I see as normal. Like my brothers and I saw ourselves as normal. We didn't really think too much about it. And then like things would come up, right? Like I remember this was also in elementary school. We go to a roller skating rink and the manager kicked us out because of their headwear policy, right?
Whoa.
Like no turbans here. And we're kids. That's so like we don't know. We're upset and it doesn't seem right.
Yeah.
So like those kinds of things happen and they form an impression on you. But it's not like that moment was so seared into my consciousness that like everywhere I went, I was looking for some sort of bigotry or discrimination or something. So it's like, it's this funny existence where like you only know what's normal to you. Marginalization in general, like that just, it weighs on you and it really can take a toll over time. But one of the things that I draw from my tradition as a Sikh is this idea of what we call charivikala, like always finding optimism in everything. And I think the power of that really, right, like it is sort of somewhat forced. There's bad stuff happening all the time and painful stuff that you have to deal with. But being able to find hope doesn't just mean that you're deluding yourself into some false reality. Yeah. It also means that you are then giving yourself a direction to go and shaping yourself as a person, right? Like what kind of person do you want to be and how do you grow into it despite all the nastiness that's out there. And I think that to me has been the power of that idea.
Wow. That's amazing. How has that influenced your masculinity? Do you think it has?
Let me say this. Like my experiences as a Sikh man have really pushed me to lean into the idea of Charivikala. And I'll explain what I mean by that. You know, in our tradition, it's theologically clear, ideologically clear. Like every Sikh will accept that our tradition teaches men and women are equal. But there are a couple of ways in which that doesn't play out in reality, right? Like just like any ideology. Right. And one of the ways is the norm has become that sick men are more visibly identifiable. Sick men wear the turban. Women have the option to, but don't as commonly. And then because of our facial hair as well, like we really stick out as men. And you know, the kind of things that you and I have been alluding to, like this appearance of having brown skin, facial hair, turban, like it just puts us into this category, not just being visible, but looking like who most Americans perceive to be the enemy.
Yeah.
And so it's been this like weird thing about sick masculinity, meaning that we then become targets in our day-to-day lives and then have to figure out how to negotiate that. And for some people, it's not worth it, right? And they say, you know, I'd rather not wear a turban and not have a beard. Mm-hmm. And for me, the way that I've tried to manage this issue has been to figure out what values, this idea of Jardabikala I was talking about, through this lens of optimism, what values can I lean into from my tradition that can then help me navigate the sort of hate and bigotry that I encounter and that our community deals with?
When I think about my personal masculinity and how I handle insults, I usually feel like I want justice. Rarely do I ever act on that feeling.
Yeah.
But I want to feel satisfied knowing that the person who crossed the line and hurt me was hurt themselves, not physically, but like maybe verbally, or I don't know. I feel a bit emasculated by it.
Yeah.
I feel as though I wasn't able to protect myself from it. And I worry that might happen a lot for people who are the victim of verbal abuse. And I worry that might have an impact on some kids' masculinity.
Yeah. So my main office is at NYU. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite ways of commuting home is running, running along the river and back to my apartment. And I'm running and I have my headphones in and I hear this guy shouting at me and he's yelling racial slurs, like he's calling me Osama. And typically when somebody yells at me, I just sort of ignore it, and especially if I'm working out, like I'd rather just keep running.
Yeah.
But I turn back and I see he's a young kid, probably like 18, 20.
Wow.
If I was to just sort of see this from the lens of victimization, I would just sort of see it as, oh, this guy's another bigot. He hates me because of how I look. Like, my life sucks. Right? Which is a very common and understandable way of responding to this stuff when you're just dealing with toxicity all the time.
Yeah.
But because of this idea of looking for the silver lining or looking for hope, I decided to go talk to them.
Wow.
And it was a good conversation. Like, I talked to him about why I thought it was messed up. And really, I think what he said to me at the end of it, he said, I was just joking. I didn't mean it. Me and my friends just thought it was funny. And I think just like we see with young people and other people, like you try to be funny and you say things that cross the line sometimes. And so I think what came out of that situation, and not every situation ends up like this, right? But what comes out of that is then you have three or four kids who are there together. And they walk away being like, all right, I understand why that was messed up and I don't want to do that again.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that's probably my best story, my best outcome. So that's why I shared that one. So like those in those situations, they're not personal at all. Like they're not about me. Like these people are mad at someone else. They have no idea who I am. They don't know anything about me. And so it's actually quite easy once you figure out how to deal with something like that. To not take it personally and therefore not feel emasculated, right? Like, this is not my problem. This is their problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it's my problem in the sense that I recognize that this sort of mentality could lead to harm or violence for others. And that's where I want to step in and really get into the education piece. But in those situations, I don't actually feel emasculated.
Last year, I was on Park Avenue. I was waiting for... I'd like sent some camera equipment to get repaired. The guy said come at a certain time and it wasn't ready. So I was like waiting outside, kind of hanging out. And this guy who was drunk, smelled terrible, had to be like some kind of dark liquor on his breath. And he said, hey, if any of your cousins back home ever want to blow up the city. I'm going to put a gun to your head. And he put his finger on my forehead. And he's like, I'm going to blow your brains out. And I was thinking in my head, like, this motherfucker, like, this is crazy. I was, like, about to do something. But just the fact that it happened, I was still, I was kind of silent for a second. And I was sort of, like, drinking all that in. And I looked him right in the eye and I was like, what? Like, I couldn't have any words. And his friend came from behind him, who was like also drunk. They might have been like drinking at a happy hour or whatever. Pulled just go, oh, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. And they kind of like both, you know, disappeared into the crowd of New York City. And that was that. And I was left humiliated. I was left thinking so poorly of myself. Like, it kind of almost didn't. It didn't have me thinking about politics or implications at that point. It just kind of felt like, yo, this is my city. I was born like 3 miles from here, just in Jersey City. And I'm thinking to myself, oh man, like, this sucks. Like, I felt shittier. I felt like shittier.
Yeah. I mean, let me just first let you know that I'm with you. Like, I've been in that same spot, mm-hmm. like over and over again. So that story I told about the kid who I talked to while running and like walked away with a good outcome. What I didn't tell you was less than a week before that, a woman like right outside my home, 2 blocks from where I live, was yelling racist stuff at me.
Man.
And I was walking down the street. And I've been dealing with this stuff my whole life, right? So like I should have known what to say, but I had no idea. Like I froze. I totally froze. And I felt that same sort of humiliation. Like I was totally ashamed of myself. Like so much so that I like couldn't sleep that night. And then I ended up posting on Facebook and Twitter. Like I just put a message out there being like, hey, this happened. What do you think I should have done? Mm-hmm. And it was really like I spent the night thinking to myself what I wished I would have done. And I couldn't come up with what the right answer was. Like we're put in this position constantly where we have to somehow deal with someone's anger and hatred for something that has nothing to do with us, mm-hmm. but it's yeah. And so how do you deal with that? I don't know.
Yeah. It's kind of like an impossible situation. Like you said, lose.
Part of it is just preparing ourselves, right? Like knowing what kinds of situations we might end up in and then being ready. And then, I mean, that to me is the opposite of emasculating, right? Like that to me was really empowering to be able to have this conversation, be like, yeah, I can turn this lose-lose situation into a win because I have that agency to do so.
As a journalist, I have these kinds of conversations all the time. Some of you listening right now might know me from my video series, Who's Afraid of Ayman Ismail? It let me have those conversations on my terms, and he's right, it was really empowering. But you can't expect anyone and everyone to want to. But Simran has chosen to embrace this mantle. It's who he is.
The thing about being sick is that I make a conscious decision every day to look the way that I do. And that's been true since childhood. And what's, I think, what I've taken away from that and what in retrospect I think has been transformative for me is when you learn to embrace being different, right? Rejecting social norms consciously and intentionally, when you can do that, it's a lot easier to let go of some of what otherwise could be quite intoxicating social expectations. Mm. So I think from my own experience, being able to just be like, I'm different, screw the rules. It made it a lot easier for me to not give in to some of what I think would be otherwise really negative ways of dealing with the hate that came my way, which would be like being overly defensive or aggressive or violent or, you know, any of those things.
Yeah.
You know, I would say that so much of what I learned through my experiences and the way in which I've come to embody my identity is very feminine in that sense, right? Like I talk about love all the time and I'm like a brown skinned bearded turban man who like people probably aren't expecting to talk about love, but that for me has been only possible because I don't really care what people think, right? And I mean I do, like I care what people think, but I don't actually feel like I need to live into a certain model of what it means to be a certain way within this world, right? Like it's easy for me to reject that, and I think it's only easy for me to reject it because I've never really lived that way before. I've chosen. It's been a conscious decision to be different. And I think that, yeah, that's been the big thing. And that for me has been, you know, realizing the power of that experience, and the power of what that can do has then become the impetus for my idea of how this world can change. And so it's not, I wouldn't say that it's an exclusively Sikh message or particular to my Sikh experience. I think that these are universal takeaways that can come through all sorts of case studies, communities, experiences, people. And that's sort of how I've thought about education. Like everything I do, whether it's, you know, writing columns and articles or showing up on TV or being in the classroom or working on civil rights cases, like it all goes back to that core piece of education. Like, how do we bring these values to bear in our society, which needs them so badly? I think that's to me is the big question of our time.
I've dealt with religious and racial harassment for what feels like my entire life. When it happens, I brush it off and try not to think about it. I don't want to think that I can't handle it, so most times I don't even try to. But now I think that that approach might stop me from feeling and healing, and I end up carrying it around with me like grief. In a lot of ways, it shaped the man that I am today. Because I've never digested what I've gone through, discussing it with someone who has, like Simranjeet Singh, felt really good. By verbalizing it, it became real. He doesn't take it personal, and I'm still learning to handle it that way. Instead of internalizing it, Simran is showing me how to find the optimism and some semblance of control. And that feels like a good place to start. Man Up is hosted and written by me, Amin Ismail. Our producers are Cameron Drews and Danielle Hewitt. Our executive producers are Jeffrey Bloomer and Lowen Liu. Gabriel Roth is the editorial director of Slate Podcasts. June Thomas is the senior managing producer of Slate Podcasts. And TJ Raphael is the senior producer of the Slate Podcast Network. You can email us at manup@slate.com and tell us what you think of the show and offer suggestions. Is there a conversation you think we should be having? Let us know. And please leave us a review in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. We'll be back next week with more Man Up.